Oh, welcome to A Week in the News. I'm Chris Scott, and today I'm joined, as always, by Mike Kelly. You right, Mike?
Hi, Chris.
Busy week this week, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Lots of paperwork in front of him, lots of research, which is good to see. And Kate Proctor, who's freshly back from a nice vacation. How was it, Kate?
Yeah, I had a great time, thank you. But much better being back in here.
Where did you go?
Went to Italy.
Ooh, very nice.
It was lovely.
All right, well, it's been a busy week to come back to, with all the parties releasing the manifestos. Mike, we'll start with you. Can you pick out just a couple of key points that you think's worth discussing?
There's a couple of things, particularly from the Conservative Party manifesto. So it seems to be a massive, great giveaway, an unfunded giveaway, which I think they've been pulled up on. The two main things are the extra money they give to the NHS, the £8 billion. Asked how they're going to fund that, they resorted to their fail-safe measure, which is to just trust us. We'll find the money. The same as when they said they were going to find £12 billion worth of cuts. They say our record in government shows that we fulfil our promises, which is obviously open to debate. But they found those two particularly hard to sell, as have they done with the extension of the right to buy to housing association tenants. That is basically going to give the right to buy to 1.3 million housing association tenants. This is obviously a follow-on from the famous Margaret Thatcher policy in the 80s, which hastened her to power. They're hoping the magic will work twice for them. But within days of that being announced, a lot of people are raising question marks about exactly how will that be funded and will it actually rebound on them?
Yeah, it's interesting the right to buy, because the whole point is from what the Tory government are saying at the moment, they're saying this is going to benefit working people.
They say that, but it's going back to the problems of the 1980s. They're saying, right, we're going to allow 1.3 million people to buy these houses, but what's going to replace those 1.3 million houses if they are actually bought?
Yeah.
It's, again, we've got this supply-demand thing. There is a housing crisis, i.e. a shortage of houses. This is just going to add to it.
Yeah.
Certainly. I mean, that's not helping first-time buyers, and I know they'll say they've got a raft of policies that support first-time buyers, but this is something different, and I don't think it's really addressing the shortage in Britain. And also the fact that once these houses have gone, they've gone from the system forever. And in places like London or the bigger cities, there has to be greater protection on that, I think.
Yeah.
Nick Forbes told me this week that, you know, of everything he heard, from the Labour point of view, listening to the Tory manifesto, that was a bonkers one.
I've got an interesting stat here, because with the right to buy, obviously, and Thatcher's policy in the 80s has become quite popular, and a lot of people have been talking about it, and our sister paper, The Mirror, did a little bit of an investigation, and on what they found was a third of the ex-council houses sold in the 1980s under Thatcher are now owned by private landlords.
Well, there we go.
Well, there's one thing. And this is another thing that I found quite interesting, and I don't know whether people believe in conspiracy theories, but this is a good one. Charles Gow, the tycoon, and his wife own at least 40 ex-council flats that were made available to buy in the 80s under Thatcher. Now, Charles Gow is the son of Ian Gow, who was one of Thatcher's top aides, and at the height of Right to Buy, he was the housing minister. So, you know,
it's something that's wide open, isn't it? For yeah. You don't know whether you'd want to use the word abuse there, but I think at the heart of it, once those houses have gone, they've gone, and within a few years, they're in private hands, and people can swoop in and buy a whole raft of them, and it completely does a disservice to the people that need social housing. And I'd say after 5 years of cuts, I would say the need's never been greater.
Yeah, I mean, there's I'm afraid his name escapes me, but one of the biggest landlords is a Tory MP who's bought these housing estates down in London. There was stories a month or two ago about, I think it's the E15, where they stage sit-ins there, because what's happened, his company is taking over these housing association buildings, and it looks like the rent is going to rocket, because he can charge what he likes in London. And these are the problems that are thrown up by policies like this. It's a short term, as someone said, it's good politics. Long term, it's very, very bad policy. It's gonna pay the country dear if they actually do follow through with this.
So let's go on the other end of the spectrum, in terms of, obviously, the Tories are very keen to carry on with austerity, and that was made clear again in their manifesto. Kate, I know this week you've been looking very much into the Green Party and what they're standing for.
Yeah.
Completely against austerity.
Yeah, they are. So in the same, you know, like Nicola Sturgeon, and that's where the comparison abruptly stops. They're an anti-austerity choice, and I think it's interesting that it's out there. It's something that people have to consider, and I think what we're looking at is the Conservative Party, Labour Party, Lib Dems, the three biggest. They're all various different versions of neoliberal economics and a neoliberal way of thinking, and you could reject that choice if you want, and I think that's exactly the argument that the Greens are trying to make on the doorsteps this time round. And I think they're a bit of a lone voice, to be honest, but they are presenting something that's important for the debate for it to be considered. I feel in a way that the manifesto, it has this figure that they would borrow $338 billion to fund what they want to do, and I think after 5 years, I think people are just scared to death of the word borrowing.
You say that, but in the manifesto they've also said that they're going to cut UK borrowing to £21 billion by 2019.
I'm not too sure about that figure itself, but I think what we know in the whole, the part is from what the party have said, is that they will do what they can, and they will, based on this figure of £338 billion, that's what they need to... That's what they need to make everything happen.
Yeah, I mean, borrowing, like Kate said, is the B word that no one dares speak. But yes, they're addressing it. They're saying end austerity. But I think the £21 billion you talk about, that's going to be met by the extra taxes they're going to implement on the people who can afford to pay it.
Yeah.
Again, it's looking at their policies. It's very left-wing policies.
Yeah, incredibly left-wing.
And I'm sure there are a lot of people who are reading them with great interest. Almost socialist, dare we say, these policies. Mm. They're also like taking on the torch of the Labour Party from the past.
They've really gone for it. I mean, that's what the word is. If you talk to young Greens, that's what they're all sort of primed and ready to say. They're unashamedly left, and that's what they'll be saying to you on the doorstep. If you voted Labour, you should vote for us, because we are the most left choice out there. There's no apologies for that. I mean, the Green Party has roots in lots of different areas, including sort of conservative ecology, conservative ideas about rural protection, and there's a whole stream of thought that came through in the 70s. So the Greens have always been quite a disparate bunch, but I think this time they've all decided if it's British Green Party, it's a left-wing party.
But you also tweeted this week that you weren't that impressed with the Young Greens.
I wasn't impressed with the Young Greens in Newcastle because they didn't know the names of who they were running against. And I totally understand you are a candidate on paper alone, and that people do complain if they don't even have the choice of a Green. But I think, you know, you should know who you're running against. I think that's just polite.
Yes.
And so we could literally spend, I think, the next couple of hours dissecting every single manifesto, all the Labour manifestos and the Liberal Democrats manifestos, UKIP's manifestos, which is bonkers, if you ask me, because I was reading about how these manifestos are going to affect local governments, and when it came to UKIP, when it came to the question of how local councils are going to be funded under a UKIP government, it was completely unclear, and I just thought that was crazy. If you're going to outline your manifesto, it's got to be about grassroots, it's got to be about what the local councils and how that's going to play out. But instead of really getting into all the manifestos and stuff, I want to raise the question of, it's virtually guaranteed that no party will win an outright majority in this next election. It's going to be a hung parliament. We've moved away from the two-party system of Labour and Conservatives more towards a German-Jewish model of politics, where it's minority politics, really, and the minority parties have got to make up and help a government form or help form a government. So given that no party is going to win a majority, do these manifestos matter, because no one's going to be able to implement it?
Well, I think what you've got now is, I mean, all the parties will say, as Ed Miliband is saying, as David Cameron is saying, yes, we are aiming to get a majority. We fully think we will. Even the TV debate last week, when he was so publicly quoted by Nicola Sturgeon, he rejected it, saying he's looking for majority. But now, in the back of the mind, they're saying these are what we stand for. So it's almost like a checklist. Labour represents this, and you can play a little game, right? Which other party do their policies agree with? So you do a little checklist. Labour and Tory, not going to happen. Labour and Green, there's a few common grounds there they can work on. and ditto
not
with
Trident.
Yes, not Trident. To be frank, I think if Labour was really honest with itself, it would like to get rid of Trident. I mean,
I just want to pick something up. So they've said here that we would like to reduce Trident to a minimal credible nuclear deterrent level. I mean, a minimal credible.
that could only make sense if you get rid of it.
Yeah.
Because it's £100 billion over, 30 years? It's just unaffordable. It's just such
a Labour phrase, that minimal credible, and we've heard it from the cuts in Newcastle, but I just think, what a nothing thing to say.
It adds credence to what was said in the TV debate, that Labour, it's always a halfway house, it's always a Tory light, or...
Since the 80s, they've always been scared of their own shadow, Labour, the shadow being the right-wing press. They're always conscious of how they portray themselves. They don't want to be seen as weak and vacillating. It's almost courting the right-wing press. They're almost like foreseeing the attacks, where they're going to come before they come, instead of just like the Greens have done, saying, this is what we stand for, take us or leave us. Mm. That's the problem with Labour since the 80s. It's like I say, it's been... Anyone who lived through that and saw the grief they got... can kind of understand why they're self-consciously trying to play the middle ground all the time. But there must come a time when they've got to say, this is what we stand for. I think perhaps this election might be that time.
And you, as you said, Mike, you know, you're looking at the manifestos and you're kind of trying to link up which party fits with one. It's like a jigsaw that you're trying to piece together. From the manifesto main points and from the manifestos that we've read this week, Kate, where do you think the coalition's going to come?
I find it utterly bizarre that both UKIP and the Greens are both offering an in-out referendum on the EU. I mean, that's just an example, I think, of how actually meaningless manifestos can be. Because, I mean, that's complete polar opposites, and then yet they've come up with the same strategy. So they've just chucked that one out there. Labour won't work with the Liberal Democrats, is what I feel. I don't think that's going to happen.
That was a good phrase this week where I think Liberal Democrats said they would be the heart to a Conservative government and the head and the brain to a Labour government, which kind of made me think that they were just the cowardly lion out of the Wizard of Oz, which I think if we're looking at this Conservative government, I think that you could make the argument.
Yeah, they set themselves up for a fall there by saying that, really.
Just a little bit.
I think it's going to be a Labour minority government, and I think they're going to seek support from the Nationalists, from SNP and Plaid Cymru.
In some ways I disagree. I think we're as dismissing the chances of them working with Lib Dems, I think they will, but obviously it will be
without Nick Clegg. Yeah, of course.
There'll be a hugely symbolic embracing when I think
they'll be going for his head.
Yes, it's after. I mean, when the Lib Dems are talking with Labour before at the end of last election, talking about forming a coalition, Nick Clegg made it clear that he wouldn't work with Labour with Gordon Brown, so Gordon Brown was somewhat humiliated by him having to step down so publicly. He's used as a bargaining chip, whereas this time around, Labour have long memories. If they do actually sit down and decide to work with them or contemplate working with them, one of the stipulations is get rid of Nick Clegg.
Absolutely.
So there is a chance in that respect. With Labour also, obviously, we'll have the Conservative link. That would be hilarious if they actually formed a coalition with them. Obviously, not UKIP. So I would think Labour's bedfellows, if they are to be, would be the Greens, which would, I think, add a bit of spice to them.
But they're only going to maximum get 2 seats.
I know, but those 2 seats might be very important, the way things are shaping,
so
you never know. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the Lib Dems and, of course, the SNP.
The SNP is an interesting one because I think they hold all the cards, I think, when it comes to this election.
She's got to be really careful now, though, Nicola Sturgeon. Yeah. We've seen her rise, we've seen her shine. And I think now we don't want to see her do anything too weird.
Yeah, she's the Nick Clegg of this election, isn't she? I feel like she's on TV, and I think if you looked at Google, she was the most Googled phrase, was Nicola Sturgeon.
Yeah.
And the second
social media interaction.
Yeah, the second most phrase was "Can I vote SNP in England?" Mm-hmm. Which I thought was really interesting because and if you look at what she said on the telly, it's left wing policy. So it's a lot more left than Labour in many respects. And so it does see what you said, Mike. You know, about the Green Party, it does seem like people are looking for a viable left wing party to vote for.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like an excuse if they hooked up with the Greens to be more socialist. We have to do this because the Greens say it as part of the agreement.
Yeah.
They would not be too displeased if they had to implement a a sort of binning of the Trident programme.
And it would be good PR for Labour, I think, to have a Green influence in there, definitely. I feel that Nicola Sturgeon just risks coming across as just, I think, just arrogant. I felt this week in that TV debate, there was just real glimpses there of just like, yeah, I'm totally aware of the power that I have this week, tonight, in this moment on TV. And I didn't think that, personally, she ended up coming across too well. It just turned for me a little bit.
I think she overplayed her hand.
Yeah.
It was like, I think we talked after the debate the day after, saying it looked like they were holding a private meeting in public.
Yeah.
She shouldn't have gone on so strong, because she just backed him into a corner. She should have been conscious that there's no way he could have, in a live national TV debate, say, yeah, let's get together and talk about this. There's no way he could do that.
Yeah.
And she overplayed her hand. She came over a bit too forceful, a bit too almost bullying at times.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that played too well with the viewing audience. It made people feel a bit uncomfortable about her.
From the TV debate, then, Nicola Sturgeon, probably, as you said, Kate, didn't come across as well as she did previously on April 2nd. Who came out the best then?
I would find that really difficult to pick an overall winner on that. I think it was an interesting one, because I think actually Ed Miliband did do well. He held his ground and he got his message across, which was, you know, we're not going with the SNP. I think that was the main point of that evening for him, really. I thought he argued well. I think the public are getting used to him and the style and the way in which he does things.
His style, I do have to interrupt you here, his style is really annoying me, because because I know he's been working with David Axelrod, who was Obama's chief advisor from when he was back in Illinois running for Senate. But he isn't Barack Obama. He doesn't have the charisma, the aura about him to pull off looking straight down the camera or smiling all the time. I just think it comes off really weird. I think he just comes, and I like Ed Miliband, what he says. I think he comes across really well. It's the way he says it. It just, I don't know what it is.
I actually think that there's a couple of things I like which he does, and one which is when he just appears to out honest everyone else, and he just says from the start, we got it wrong, yeah, we made a mistake. No one else does that in the way he does, and I think it's quite disarming, and it's quite good. He did it again this week,
taking the attack away before it's thrown at you.
Yeah.
He also gives the impression that he's got more than one or two gears like Cameron has. Cameron will always say what you expect him to say, and he won't be deflected from it. So you get the impression sometimes Miliband is thinking on his feet, and he will consider other people's arguments and take it on board. Hence the honesty Kate's talking about. It's something you wouldn't expect from Cameron.
No.
And so I think
we've got to talk about Cameron, though, because that really was the main thing, wasn't it?
Well, we're not sure about the winners, but the biggest loser of the night has to be David Cameron for not being there.
Yeah, there was that. Going back to, I thought after the debate, I was very impressed by Natalie Bennett. I thought, wow, because she came across, she was a lot more confident than she was in the first TV debate. She got her opinions across well. She came across as fair-minded and decent, intelligent. I even liked it when she kicked off, demanding to be heard.
I thought she came across as a petulant child when she did that.
It's
my turn to speak. Well, don't scream down the camera. And I thought no one, people picked up on it, but I don't think it was as widely seen as it was because of the camera angle at that certain point when she did it. I thought she got away with it.
No, I quite like that. I like someone's. She was being snubbed, and she saw she was being snubbed, so she tried to draw attention to herself so she could speak.
Like a polar opposite view on immigration as well.
Yeah.
I mean,
that
was refreshing to hear at least some diversity on that.
Mm.
Yeah.
I always, after she did kick off, though, I did think it was funny where David Dimbleby said to Ed Miliband, "Oh, Ed, have you got something to say?" And he just went, "I think it's Natalie's turn to speak," because he was like, "Yeah, I'm not getting, I don't want to shouting at me again." So I thought that was quite funny. But moving on to the losers of the night, and I think it's fair to say, David Cameron got a kicking, didn't he?
He did. David Cameron for not turning up. Labour played it to the hilt. I liked Ed Miliband's High Noon bit at the end, said, "Come and debate me." This kind of thing, it was a bit weird. Clegg as well. I mean, because he got a kicking, but no one mentioned them afterwards.
No.
It just showed how insignificant they have kind of become in the election, that no one even saw fit to have a pop at the Lib Dems for not going there. Granted, he said he wanted to go and was blocked for some reason, But all the same, were they mentioned in it?
I just really feel the fact that he tweeted, party tweeted, yeah. We would have gone, but we weren't invited. I mean, all right, do something else on the night then.
Don't go to the pub. Nick Clegg's in the pub having a pint rather than even seemingly watching the
pub. Was he in the pub in Sheffield Hallam?
I don't know. I can't remember where it was, but he was just in the pub and it just looked like, oh, well, I don't care. And I was just like, it's just bad PR.
Well, that's Nigel Farage's play, but I suppose he was drinking a pint, wasn't he, and with the people. But Cameron, yeah, got a kick in. In some ways, they must have enjoyed it at the beginning of the debate because they did, as I think you blogged to start off with, it looked like those rumours that they were all going to gang up on him, and it seemed at one stage they did. And I remember writing at the time that he must be loving this, but then they kind of backed off.
Mm.
And then more and more, the longer the debate went on, the more obvious Cameron not being there it became. So yeah, he was the big loser of the night.
I just think these things are really important, and I think the establishment have to embrace this change. We want to see them on TV, and I think they have to accept that that's part of the election political process.
And it's only 6 weeks as well. This is my thing, and obviously I lived in America during two election campaigns, 2008 and 2012. They go on for 2 years. They start campaigning for 2012 and 2010. It goes on for years, so by the end of it, you're sick of it. You know absolutely everything about that person. 6 weeks is a very short time to just go, you know what, I've got to suck it up. I've got to go and do television debates. It's not like they're asking a lot. It's not like he's got... It annoyed me because I'm thinking, you've got to show that you care. You've got to show that you want to be Prime Minister again. And every time we see David Cameron at the moment, I just think he looks fed up and he's just like, I can't be bothered with this anymore.
Mm. He doesn't have. He doesn't appear to have too much passion. But then I wouldn't underestimate David Cameron.
Well, it's an interesting point that, because I still think we're waiting for our... like moments, there's no turning point. It doesn't matter what's happened. Everyone was talking before this week that the manifestos are going to come out. That's going to be a turning point. The polls have stayed the same for weeks. It's 34-34 between Labour and the Conservatives. Nothing has changed. We're still waiting for our moment, aren't we?
Well, I was reading someone last week, just waiting for the breakout moment. There's some sort of issue breaks out, like everyone's dying for a John Prescott moment when he smacks someone. Something like some standout moment. Everything's been so regimented, so smooth, that it's in some ways it's anaesthetising. Can you say that? Anaesthetising the campaign.
Yeah, pretty clean.
Yeah, the TV debates have actually enlivened them a bit.
Yeah,
which shows how sort of neutral the campaigns have been.
Do you think we're going to get a moment? I know you can't really predict these things, but I really can't see anything happen. I think it's just going to go right down to the wire.
I mean, that was some of those funny mention of Nicola Sturgeon saying she would want to work with David Cameron.
Oh, with the French ambassador.
And then she immediately said, "I didn't say that." I mean, that was I don't know what happened to that really, because that seemed to be fairly important, but that kind of went away.
I don't know. It's probably me. I was going off on one because you're talking about talking with the French ambassador. I was just thinking of that Ferrero Rocher advert. that's what they're doing, handing them round. But I suspect.
I think Nicola Sturgeon eats a Ferrero Rocher. I don't know if that's
her. I think Nigel Farage would.
He's a Ferrero Rocher man, do you reckon?
Yeah, I don't think so.
But I think if it stays like this in the last week, I think we'll see the press really sharpening its claws, coming up with stuff to try tilt the balance in favour of their chosen candidate, which will be interesting to keep
track. They're trying a lot with Ed Miliband, I think, you know, the two kitchens thing, and then it was his alleged womanising as well. I just don't think anything stuck. They're throwing everything at them but the kitchen sink at the moment, no pun intended. So I don't think anything's going to stick.
Well, the womanising thing, it wasn't really womanising, and if anything, it added a bit of colour to his character, let's face it. I mean, but actually, an interesting point from just going back to the manifestos briefly, is it's interesting looking where they do seem to agree on a couple of points, all the parties, is upping the minimum wage and upping the tax threshold. And that shows how things have changed. This is not a natural Conservative policy, I wouldn't have thought, but they kind of adopt it from the Lib Dems and see actually it's a vote winner. So there is some level of agreement there, which I find interesting. They're actually addressing the concerns of those who are fortunate enough to be in a job to get a higher salary. So there is some common ground there. I think that's an interesting point.
I know the press from the start, the national press, were fearful that this would be potentially a very dull election because of the intense management of debate and the intense management as well as the time that you get with politicians. And we've had some regional papers so far, in the past week, saying you can't believe it, we just had a minute, or we were held in a pen whilst the TV got their chance, and we're the local press and we didn't get to have any time to interview them. And I think that's such a massive shame, and things are just becoming so reduced down. And there's a visit tomorrow, a Labour visit tomorrow, and you just know you're going to go and you're going to get 40 seconds max, which is just not really good enough.
I'm just going to control it. The report has been kettled.
Interesting. Yeah, that was a strange one, because that was Rachel Weirmouth, yeah, wasn't it? She being basically told, go back into your pen. It's like, I'm sorry. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And having to pay to join the party buses as well to go out on the road,
Yeah.
Having to pay to shadow and pay to follow them. It's just something's been a bit lost. So yeah, I'm dying for a Prescott punch moment.
We almost had one. That guy who was playing the ukulele in North.
That was brilliant.
The guy exactly. Yeah. Well, we won't sing the song he was singing, because
I can bleep that, make it okay.
But it was funny when he was making his displeasure with Cameron and telling him where to get off known, and it was interesting the policeman coming across trying to hurry him away, but the guy wouldn't move. Well, that was amusing. More of that, please.
Yeah, and we had the two musicians do the same at the UKIP rally as well, wasn't it? So that was interesting. Just touching on UKIP slightly. Watching the TV debate the other night, and I thought Nigel Farage came across not well at all. And I usually think he's a good speaker. I don't agree with what he says, but I think he puts his point across well. And by having a go at the audience, the live studio audience, was a mistake. I think it showed him off as petty. And then I just think UKIP, as the longer this election goes on, I think they're just falling away as a bit of a joke.
To be honest, no, I don't think so. I think that was he might even have scripted that, because he comes from the right, and they always have this thing in their bonnet about the BBC being right, left wing bias, which is complete rubbish. You actually look at the structure of the BBC; it's very right wing.
Yes,
but that's so. I think he's almost waiting to put that in, because the MO for the UKIP party is it's the outsiders' party. So if he's there doing the TV debate and everything seems against him there, he's like fighting for the outsiders, who are the important people were watching, as he said. So I think that fits the MO of what the UKIP party represents.
Yeah, I agree. Him doing that would have spoken to a lot of people, and it was probably quite a powerful little trick that he played. And I, as well, policies on immigration, he keeps bringing it back round, and he said something like, I'm thinking what you're thinking, and it's all oh dear. But he just constantly does directing the viewer in their living room, sat on their sofa, very well. Does it better than the rest.
He does, even down to the fact that if you watch at the end when there was the group hug by all the female leaders, and Ed Miliband walks across to shake their hands. In the distance, there was Nigel Farage, the man on the outside. I think this is all very much structured. I think he's a lot more politically savvy than people give him credit for. I think a lot of this is scripted. He knows what he's doing.
Rachel Weirmouth, who unfortunately couldn't be here today because I wanted to ask her about it, she wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago saying TV debates don't matter. And when she told me she was writing this piece, I argued that, yes, they do. Of course they do. That's a ridiculous thing to say. As time goes on, and I keep looking at the polls, and I know polls are representative, but they haven't moved through three TV debates now.
But that's only for the two main parties.
Yes, though, that's only
it?
For
so
the two main parties.
Say, like, Nicola Sturgeon.
Well, this is what I was going to say. Yeah. Do TV debates actually matter?
Well, I would say they do for the minority parties a lot.
Yeah. I think our principle they do. I mean, how can you judge if they're being successful or not? Would the polls be tied if we didn't have them? Would Labour be much lower than they were without the impact Ed Miliband?
Yeah, exactly. Where would Labour be without Ed Miliband actually having a chance to get out there and say, yeah, hell yeah, I'm tough enough? I mean, that would have, that we saw a bit of, it's laughable, but we saw a bit of something there, a bit of personality.
Yeah.
And it's down to that at the end of the day. It's down to how you come across.
Yeah, and we've seen Natalie Bennett. I keep going. I haven't got a thing
you
for
love
her,
Natalie
honestly.
Bennett.
But just the fact that, you know, we've seen the Green Party putting forward an interesting manifesto. We're actually seeing her, getting a chance to hear her speak without brain freezes, and some of it's quite impressive. So I have really enjoyed reading
the Green Manifesto this week. It's really it's just brought up loads of questions, and it's great to have that edge in there for a bit of difference.
So yes, they do. I mean, for democracy's sake, sounds a bit pompous, but it's good to have your leaders who are actually fighting for your vote. And secondly, it gives them a chance to decide, actually see it physically in front of you. I mean, like we said, do TV debates matter? David Cameron didn't turn up. We're talking for a few minutes about who was the biggest loser of the night. He lost because he didn't turn up for a TV debate.
It's a fantastic point. And what we'll finish on is, I can't even remember how far away we are from it. A couple of weeks now, isn't it? 2.5 weeks until May the 7th now, and voter registration's tomorrow, ends tomorrow. So if you haven't registered yet and you've still got time, go and do it, please. So who do we think is ahead? Going into it, if you had to pick one, what do you think's going to happen?
It's difficult because they're neck and neck, and it's someone to come up with that fantastic idea which grabs your imagination. Alternatively, someone who drops a big bomb and it rebounds on them. So we don't know. It's impossible to tell at this moment in time, which makes it all the more fascinating. Just to see how it does evolve until the actual election. It'll be interesting to see.
I think the Conservative Party from that TV debate, we didn't get any support for them apart from UKIP, which they already knew of anyway. And I think that's. I feel this week what's changed for me is the position of the Conservative Party, because I feel like there are many, many different ways and arrangements and solutions out there if Labour don't get the number of seats they need. What I can't see is a range of solutions for the Conservative Party. In equal measure, I don't think they have as many options. So I think that's probably now for them that's the key thing to look at.
It's a good point. The only natural bedfellow, to use that phrase again, is UKIP. Lib Dems once bitten, as they say. Even if you look, people forget about the Northern Ireland MPs. There's not many Northern Ireland MPs, the old Conservative and Union Party. There's not many like-minded people in Northern Ireland. Again, if you're talking about the SDLP, for example, one of the main parties in Ireland, that's another person who Labour could potentially hook up with. So it looks like, at the moment, Labour kind of holds all the cards.
Mm. It's not been a good week for the Conservatives, I don't think.
And on that bombshell, Kate's writing the piece about the Green Party this week. Kate, can you just give us a little thing about that and when that's going to be in the paper?
Yeah, so it'll be in the Journal tomorrow.
Monday.
And it'll also be online as well. And it's a look at the Green Party, and it's a look at how they might take votes from Labour. But more it's looking at the Green Party marketing itself as the left wing. And is everyone within the party comfortable with that kind of new branding?
And Mike, have you got anything exciting coming up this week?
No, but I'm interested.
Nothing.
No, nothing great. But I was actually looking. One thing I forgot to mention, just today, Sunday, suddenly Boris Johnson's hold interview. He's been quiet. That shows how perhaps desperate the Conservatives are. He's made his Churchillian speech about saving Britain from Labour. So that shows how, I'm sure if David Cameron and George Osborne had a choice, they wouldn't have him speaking and coming to the forefront, because obviously Osborne sees himself as a rival X years down the line as a leader of the Conservative Party. So it shows they're getting a bit desperate now. They're throwing in their joker, shall we say, in the game.
He's no joker.
Brilliant. Well, it's going to be another fascinating week, and we'll speak to you again after, hopefully, we've had our political moment. See you now.